Good evening and welcome behind the news for September 25th, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, although it's a little off the beaten track show tonight. We're going to be looking at a couple of independent media, a couple of important magazines. We often whine a lot about the big corporate media and how bad they are, and certainly a lot of that is justified, but there's also a lot of good obscure media not out there, doesn't have big budgets, doesn't have necessarily big circulations, but they're doing important stuff. Of course, this radio station and this network is an example of that, but I'm talking about magazines in this case. The Baffler and Bitch magazine. The Baffler, a journal of cultural criticism published out of Chicago for the last 10 years or so, and a collection of essays from The Baffler called Boob Jubilee has just been released. The Cultural Politics of the New Economy, and we'll speak with the editor of The Baffler and the co-editor of that collection, Tom Frank. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak to the editor of Bitch magazine, whose tagline is Feminist Responses to Pop Culture, about feminism, pop culture, and independent publishing. Lisa Jervis at about 5:30, 5:35. And before we get to those topics, first of all, the usual review of the economic news. And let me start with a bit of good news from Western Europe, where good news has been rather scarce. The so-called IFO Business Climate Index for Germany was released today, and it showed the fifth consecutive increase in September. The IFO Business Climate Index is a survey of business attitudes, evaluations of the current situation and expectations for the future. And these attitude surveys are interesting as early warning signs, although attitudes don't necessarily translate into investment and hiring and the actual expenditure of money. And but they are an early warning sign, and that one in Germany is pointing up. So there are increasing signs that the European economies are recovering, and I'm sort of working with this suspicion that we've had a couple of decades now of rotation among the major economies of the world. 1970s were sort of Europe's decade. The Swedish model was thought to be one that would be emulated around the world. Well, that didn't work out. But the 1980s, then, we saw Japan as the star economy. And it was Japan was going to be taking over the world, and they were buying up properties all over the place and eating our lunch and sending us the bill. And by the end of the 80s, that miracle had crashed and burned, and both Europe and Japan spent much of the 90s mired in economic stagnation, while the United States became the star of the global economy. Most regions of the world were not doing so well. Parts of Asia were doing quite well in the 90s, but much of the rest of the world, Latin America, was doing rather poorly. Europe and Japan were doing rather poorly. Africa was doing very, very, very badly. But the United States was the star and supposedly the envy of the world, the great economic model for everyone else to emulate. Well, that's no longer the case either. I'm wondering if either Japan or Western Europe is going to have its day in the sun once again, while the U.S. sort of grinds along in a generally troubled atmosphere. The increase in the business climate index in Germany is a sign, yet another sign, that Europe's economy may be getting up off the mat. And getting back to the United States, where the big question is our economy recovering? And if so, how strong a recovery? Well, that question remains unanswered. We did get some releases over the last, for today and the last couple of days, both the sales of new and existing houses came out this morning, and in both cases were stronger than expected, and the housing market continues to be very, very strong. This, however, is kind of old news. It's no surprise at all. There was no recession in the housing business, low interest rates, and a great deal of optimism about the prospects for the housing market. Fueled a lot of spending, a lot of borrowing, a lot of mortgage borrowing. And a lot of people who thought that, well, they learned the stock market was a dangerous thing, but housing is safe. So a lot of people essentially speculating with their residents, and that's a reckless game. A lot of evidence that some kind of bubble had been developing, especially in the major real estate markets in the country, and well, that may be coming to an end, because while the sale of houses has been strong and was strong in September, the demand for mortgages has been slipping. Interest rates are rising a bit, and it may be that the great housing boom is coming to an end. Both the demand for new mortgages fell last week for the second consecutive week, and also refinancings fell as well. People have been refinancing their older mortgages, higher interest rate mortgages, and trading them in for lower interest rate mortgages, but at the same time, they've been pulling out a lot of money, cashing in on the appreciated equity value and borrowing against that. And that's one of the things that's kept the consumer economy going, but that trend seems to be running out of steam. And the so-called refi index, the refinancing index, is off now, and off considerably from its peaks of the late spring and early summer. So that housing market is cooling down. The job market of the U.S. is not really recovering like it's supposed to either. We've seen some recovery in a lot of the economic indicators, but not in employment. The economy has shed jobs now for 7 consecutive months, and we'll see if we're going to get an 8th consecutive month when the September employment report is released next month. But it's next week, rather. But it's been a dismal performance. The count of first-time applications for unemployment insurance, a very sensitive indicator released every Thursday morning, fell last week, but a good bit of that fall can be attributed to a closure of unemployment offices because of the hurricane. So we don't really have a good picture of the underlying trend and won't until next week's numbers are released at 8:30 on next Thursday morning. The weekly ABC Money Magazine measure of consumer sentiments also fell for the second consecutive week, and remains firmly in negative territory as people's evaluations of the national economy deteriorated, although the state of their own personal finances ticked up a bit. But in any case, personal sector is not doing so well, and a lot of worries about employment. The Conference Board also does a count of help wanted ads. They actually measure the inches of help wanted advertising in major newspapers around the country, and they publish this as an index. They have been for about 50 years, and it's also a good leading indicator of what's happening with the job market. That indicator fell in August and remains at a very, very low level. No signs of recovery in that corner. And there was some hope that investment by corporations, investment in machinery and equipment and things like that, which is what the economy really needs to pick up some steam. There was some hope that that was recovering, but also the Commerce Department reported this morning that spending for so-called non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, which is the core measure that a lot of us watch, that was off in August after a couple of months of expansion. And is just kind of struggling along and not showing the kind of bounce that we would hope. And I made some remarks last week about how there was really no generalized race to the bottom. As you hear people saying frequently that global trade deals and such have instigated a global race to the bottom, and I said, well, that's kind of untrue. There are many things happening under the surface, and there is no evidence of a generalized race to the bottom worldwide. I got an email from somebody who'd been downsized several times at successively lower rates of pay, and I hope I didn't sound callous, and I'm very sorry if I did, or flippant about the fact that a lot of individual people have been experiencing economic stress. I was talking about averages, the general tendencies, and the average rate of pay in the United States has been rising since 1995 and continued to rise during the recession. That doesn't mean that people don't lose their jobs, suffer wage cuts, or worry about economic ruin, but if you're doing a mix of political agitation, education, and organizing, you've got to get your facts straight, and no one will trust you if you don't. And in a lot of cases, people you're talking to might not recognize the world you're describing if you don't have some sense of what is happening at the average level. And please, I hope I didn't sound indifferent to what happens to real people in this economy. But that's one of the reasons I'm no fan of capitalism. It's a story of constant turmoil. Some people doing well, some people doing poorly, and wealth and poverty arising side by side. And we can certainly do a lot better with our knowledge and our resources, but we're not. And I don't mean to be Pollyanna-ish in my analysis. And a couple other remarks. I saw the president of Brazil, Lula, twice in the last 2 days, once yesterday afternoon before a labor audience at the Cornell Club of New York, of all places. The Cornell Club is in the East 40s on the former site of the headquarters of Chicago Pneumatic Tool, an old line machinery company that was driven out of existence by a bunch of financial operators in the 1980s who took it over, unlocked the value, as they like to say, and just walked away with it, leaving a lot of people without jobs. Just the kind of thing I was alluding to earlier, the kinds of downsizings and turmoil that are routine, but it did make a lot of people rich. But now it's the site of the Cornell Club, and I saw Lula talking to a labor audience there. And I saw him again this morning before the Council on Foreign Relations, on another ruling class establishment on the east side of Manhattan, and I still have the suit on to prove it. And some highlights of what Lula was saying at both places. He affirmed his commitment to economic orthodoxy. To both audiences, both to the labor and to the ruling class audience. He is bragging about the decline in inflation since he took office at the beginning of the year. When he took office, it was about 40%, and now it's down around 7%. He cited the decline in interest rates as a sign that international capital markets were going more sanguine and confident about Brazil. He said that he needed to stabilize the economy, to reduce inflation, to cut the budget deficit, and do all those orthodox things so that it can start growing. His argument is that growth can now follow once the economy has been stabilized. And he told the Council on Foreign Relations audience that he wanted to make sure that the growth was distributed more fairly than it had been in the past. But how much that will happen, we'll see. Too much equality of distribution will risk that stabilization if foreign investors and Brazilian investors as well. A reflex is always to talk about foreigners, but domestic elites do lots of damage too. If they see too much equality and equalization on the part of the government, they will panic and pull out and throw the Brazilian economy back into instability. So he's walking a very fine line economically and politically, and you have to wonder if his government can pull it off. Another interesting thing he said was talking about building solidarity in the South, moves towards greater economic, political, and even cultural integration of South Africa, and then tighter ties of South America, rather, and then tighter ties with Africa, Asia, and Russia. His attempt is to present some kind of common front by the Southern Hemisphere against the U.S., the EU, and Japan in various international forums. An early example of that was what we saw with the collapse of the World Trade Organization talks in Cancun a couple of weeks ago. But he also emphasizes he wants lower agricultural trade barriers in the rich countries, something that a lot of folks might hear or might not like to hear about. At the Council on Foreign Relations talk, he blamed the United States for allying with the European Union in agricultural protectionism. And he said that until a few weeks ago, the U.S. and Brazil shared about 70% of their trade agenda until the U.S. took this protectionist turn in alliance with the EU, no doubt the result of the Bush administration worried about their reelection prospects. Lula emphasized he didn't want to be confrontational, as he's emphasized about his domestic politics, too. He talked repeatedly of a partnership of business, labor, and civil society, saying that a party of the left, like the Workers' Party, can't govern alone, and a single country can't confront the rich world alone either. So his government is trying to take leadership of the southern forces, and they formed what is amusingly called a trilateral commission of India, Brazil, and South Africa, who aim to take a leading role among the southern countries and present a common front against the rich world. And we'll see what happens with that in the coming months. And finally, before we get to Tom Frank, who's waiting patiently on the line, I was very sad to hear of the death of Edward Said. And my former life as a student of literature, I remember the impact of his works in the late 1970s. And, of course, what most of this audience will recognize him for is his activism on behalf of Palestinians. He was a brilliant and humane man, and unlike many people on the left, wonderfully stylish. both in his prose and his life. And I think I'll try to put together some kind of tribute next week that will take into account both his literary side and his political side. Not many people around like him, and it was a very great loss. Not made it any easier to bear by the fact that we knew it was coming. And so now, after a long delay on my part, we're joined by Tom Frank, who is the editor of the Baffler magazine and co-editor of a collection of articles from that magazine called Boob Jubilee, The Cultural Politics of the New Economy, just published by Norton. Welcome to WBAI, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So,
and what's up with this negativism, Doug? Don't you know that the gross national product weighs less than ever before?
I think it's a great triumph, isn't it, Alan Greenspan? Oh, I should say that. Speaking of which, some people may have gotten a mailing from Monthly Review promising an interview today with their author Ursula Hughes, author of a book on the Cybertariat. She talks a lot about weightlessness. That interview will appear next week. I recorded it this afternoon. She's got lots and lots of stuff, good stuff to talk about, including that idea of a weightless new economy. So next week, Ursula Hughes. But now we've got Tom Frank, so let's hear from him. Tom, what for the unfortunate folks in the audience who've never heard of the Baffler, tell us about it.
Well, it started as a kind of literary magazine. And, in fact, you know, it's funny that, it's not funny, it's awful about Edward Said, but that book of his, The Word, The Text, and The Critic, was one of my favorites back in the early days of the magazine. And we were involved in a lot of those, interested in a lot of those debates about, you know, post-structuralism and everything. And we sort of grew out of that. And nowadays it's a very political quarterly. A lot of very harsh negative reviews of things, and you know, a lot of snarky remarks about the economy
and the business culture.
Exactly. One of the ways that we summarize it. See, Doug, you know this better than me. But one of the ways that we summarize it is the culture business and the business of culture. And we, among other things, we read a lot of management literature and advertising literature and sort of your backlash conservative books, and we write about them in a humorous and accessible manner.
And since I'm not the editor of the magazine, I can endorse that as an accurate description. But Boob Jubilee is a collection of essays on the wonderful moment of the new economy of the late 90s,
But it's not just about it's about the whole culture of the country in the 1990s, and it ranges everything from there's a story about the sort of terminal decline of rock and roll, you know, after once alternative was sort of brought, you know, remember alternative rock, you remember that, once all that was brought into the fold. There's a really fine essay about gentrification in Chicago, one of the essays that I'm really fond of, and then there's a lot of stuff about the stock market, including an essay by you yourself, and stuff about the sort of insane culture that was propelling the bubble. What distinguishes this book from a lot of the books that are being published right now is that these are all essays that were written at the time. So in 96, 97, 98, while the madness was going on.
And that must have been a pretty lonely pursuit.
It was. I think about that a lot. There was this time, I don't know, maybe it's maudlin to remember it now, but people often use the word schadenfreude when they're talking about this book and about, the, you know, the, but we, you know, I try not, we try really hard not to gloat about having been right about it, all this stuff, or anything like that, but there is this moment that I remember, nobody ever thinks about it anymore, but the schadenfreude of the other side, when they were constantly saying things like, you know, calling people like us dinosaurs, that we didn't get it, you know, we were obsolete. We were, you know, the magazine is still to this day paper-based. We don't have much of an online presence. And we, you know, we work very hard on the essays, and everything is edited and then edited again. And, you know, and we do all these things in a very old-fashioned manner.
Very much the opposite of the blog phenomenon, right?
Yeah, in some ways. And so, yeah, this made for a very, a very unhappy 1990s. You know how people used to say they had a good 60s. Well, we had a bad 90s. I remember one moment in New Year 2000, when 1999 was becoming 2000, and the Baffler had as its office a sort of disused parking garage in the Woodlawn neighborhood in Chicago, which some of your listeners might remember. That's where the Blackstone Rangers used to hang out. Anyhow, we were having a party there, and we had spent the 2 days previous to New Year's going around the city, going around to thrift stores and buying all the, you know, the silverware and the glasses and everything that we needed. And I remember that moment with this you know, great clarity, because after spending all this time to get these things for pennies, you know, and to scrape all this stuff together, and here we were in this kind of, you know, in this building, that the outside world was rewarding these, you know, idiots and these imbeciles with the kind of money that you and I will, you know, the amounts of money that you and I can never really understand, for doing things that were utterly worthless, and for doing things that were destructive, and for doing things that were stupid. And it was a terrible moment for me. I remember just thinking, like, what course have I chosen in life, and you know, why did I do this?
But now you don't have a pocket full of worthless stock options.
That's true. I don't have that holding me down.
So that's the comfort.
But then on the other hand, Doug, you know, it's not as though these people, the people who puffed the bubble and who you know, pumped up the new economy and who the boobs, you know, who were at play all through the 90s, it's not like they've been spanked for what they did. It's not like my colleague Diamonds Mulcahy, he likes to recall that one of the Republicans' favorite aphorisms is this phrase, ideas have consequences. They love to say this. Rush Limbaugh, in particular, loves to repeat. It was the title of a book back in the 50s or something like that.
I think it's the slogan of Hillsdale's College, too, isn't it?
Beats me. But these guys, their ideas didn't have consequences, at least not for them. And, you know, you think of a guy like Tom Friedman, you know, the author of The Lexus and the Olive Tree, the guy is still at it and is more of a celebrity than ever.
Or well, he's moved on to declaring France our enemy.
Can you believe that? And or you have, you know, George Gilder, you know, still out there, you know, Forbes magazine, totally unembarrassed by what they did. You know, the people who puffed it up have been promoted. Daniel Yergin, who wrote The Commanding Heights, they made it into a goddamn TV series last year. You know, these people just there is no downside for them. Dinesh D'Souza, who wrote one of the very last New Economy books.
Distort D'Souza, as you call it in college.
Yeah, but he just shifts back to the culture wars as though, you know, as though nothing ever happened, and he, you know, keeps going strong. Has a job at the Hoover Institute or American Enterprise Institute or whatever it is. There's, you know, there's no downside for these people.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things the right likes to say is that the market is supposed to punish you if you don't do the right thing. But these guys
that's right.
On perpetual.
Gilder himself wrote this big article about accountability, where he was saying that he didn't trust government, he didn't trust judges, and he didn't trust academia because none of them answered to the market, and hence they weren't accountable. And I was reading this, thinking, oh my God, this guy is himself, you know, responsible for so many of the bad ideas of the last decade. Where's his accountability?
Yeah, one of your themes in the magazine and in the book is the kind of the death of critical thinking during the boom, but it doesn't seem to have revived in the bust either, does it?
Not really. And what I don't know if you've – there's also a new issue of the magazine out that should be arriving in people's mailboxes, and I mean like their actual physical mailboxes any day now. And it's got an essay by me about the form that dissent has taken in the last few years and the form that our anger has taken. And it's really odd. The people that we're angry at are liberals. If you look at the bestseller list, you know, it's like Ann Coulter, Sean Hannity, Dinesh D'Souza, Gordon Liddy, you know, this kind of thing.
Although, you know, we also see this strange phenomenon where we've got people like Michael Moore and Barbara Ehrenreich and Craig Pallast in the bestseller list.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And that's a very encouraging sign. I'm very pleased about that.
I'm speaking with Tom Frank, who's the editor of the Baffler magazine and co-editor with Dave Mulcahy of Boob Jubilee, The Cultural Politics of the New Economy, just published by Norton. Well, there's so many themes in here, but one of the section headings is about authenticity. Why is that an obsession?
It was... authenticity is the cultural quality that everyone is always searching for in their consuming lives and in so many other aspects of life as well. It's the quality that makes obsolescence go. You know, last year's product was not authentic enough. This year's is. And what's funny is that you find authenticity in just all sorts of really peculiar. Well, one of the classic aspects of it that we talk about in there is in the process of gentrification. We have this essay about the gentrification of Wicker Park, and it's a neighborhood in Chicago that it's now a code word for gentrification. What's happened to this area? In fact, there's going to be a movie, a Josh Hartnett vehicle, come out next year called Wicker Park. But back in the day, it was Nelson Algren's neighborhood, and he made it famous for being, you know, populated by these real lowlifes and real Chicago, hard-bitten Chicago types. Anyhow, that's the transformation. But it's all driven by this kind of yuppie pursuit of the authentic urban bohemian life, you know, which is sold to them, and so it's sold to them by developers and restaurants and bars and that kind of thing. And so it's very curious that authenticity always winds up, the demand can never be satisfied because it always turns out to be just another product, you know, just another fabrication. And I'm fascinated by the idea of authenticity because you find it. You also find it on both the left and the right. You know, in the left, of course, that's the whole basis of identity politics is cultural authenticity. And then the right has a sort of different version of it, where the authentic person is a sort of middle American. You know, lives out in Kansas and is disrespected by the Hollywood liberal elite and that kind of thing, and by people like you and me.
I should say this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. I'm speaking with Tom Frank, who is the co-editor, along with Dave Mulcahy, of Boob Jubilee, The Cultural Politics of the New Economy, a collection of salvos, as they say on the cover, from The Baffler magazine, just published by Norton. Well, another theme of yours is the great repositioning of populism, the creation of market populism or right populism, and how people left of center became elitists. Could you talk about that a bit?
Well, that is the story of our time. You know, that's the last 30 years, ever since. I've been talking about this a lot lately. I have to tell you, I've got a new book that I'm working on that'll be out next spring that's about how these ideas work on the ground, about how right-wing populism looks on the ground. I do it by looking at my home state of Kansas, where the state has moved really far to the right just in the last 10 years, and I wonder about how that worked, how that happened. But it's also an examination of the ideas of right-wing populism. And there's two basic strains of it. One of them is the kind that we remember so fondly from the Nixon era, and especially from the speeches of Spiro Agnew, which were written for him by Pat Buchanan, in which he was always at war with the Eastern establishment, the liberal elite, and what do they call it? The liberal media, you know. And then, of course, there's the sort of contemporary version of that is the red state, blue state thesis. You remember that?
Yeah, in Nixon's case, there's always a little bit about the Jews, too, right?
Yeah, there's all of this stuff has a lot of overtones of anti-Semitism. It's a basic, what's his name? Arthur Schlesinger had this great line in one of his books where he said that anti-intellectualism is the anti-Semitism of the American businessman. And it's true. Anti-intellectualism in the hands of the right is a kind of secularized anti-Semitism. They don't talk about the Jewish conspiracy, but they talk about the intellectuals and the liberal elite in exactly the same terms that people used to talk about, you know, the Jewish conspiracy.
Now, you're about to talk about the second variant.
Yeah, which is the one that we have now, that we hear so much about now, which is the red state, blue state divide. And you remember after the election of 2000, when the map of the electoral map of the country where Gore won the states along the coasts, and then also a lot of the states in the upper Midwest, and then Bush won all the states in the middle, and they were, and on election night, those states were colored red, right? The ones that Bush won, and then the ones that Gore won were colored blue, and this, the right wingers just leapt on this. You know, this was supposed to be so significant, right? That that Bush had won the heartland, as they call it, and which Gore had won the land of the elites.
The site of authenticity, though.
That's right. And so there's the authenticity critique right there, where people like you and I, who live in these blue states, these degraded blue states, are supposed to be, you know, these affected cosmopolitan. There's another one of your code words. Cosmopolitan elites who like to drink latte and Chardonnay. That's another, you know, one of their great the campaign against Chardonnay. You know, we're supposed to like to eat, you know, fancy French cheeses and this kind of thing, whereas the people in the heartland are true Americans, and they and Bush is one of their own. And
they like, you know, to eat bad food and drink cheap beer. So.
Well, Doug, you know, now that's the attitude. That's not going to get us anywhere. I like the food in the Midwest, you know. I don't have any problem with some kinds of American beer. I really like it. But I'll tell your listeners, I mean, I know you don't care, but I was just in Wichita, and I had the finest steak I have ever had in anywhere. It was amazing. But, you know, it's Wichita. Anyhow, so, but their authenticity, according to their measure of authenticity, George W. Bush is the most authentic American that ever lived. And what's amazing to me is that it's so, to me, it's so obviously an act. You know, Bush's attitude. You know, he's so clearly a privileged frat boy. I don't know how anyone could fall for it. And so these same people who are so skeptical when they're talking about, you know, Bill Clinton or the liberal elite, and who are so, you know, attentive to every insult that they hear from the mass media, they see a guy like Bush, and they, all their defenses drop, and they're like, wow, he is a man of the people. I don't get that. I mean, I do get it, but, well, anyhow.
Wait, how did they
get it? It's Authenticity Incorporated right there, you know?
Well, I mean, you've been studying your home state now for this book. How do people on the ground articulate this? Where does this come from? How do they see somebody like Bush as being somebody just like them?
It's the way he talks. It's that he's not a show off. And this is the other thing. They would always talk about Al Gore as being a show off, which is just, you know, it's hard to understand this stuff. But you know, it's a long and complicated story. But they're deeply offended by what they believed, what they call the culture of liberalism, okay, and under which category they call, you know, everything around them, Hollywood movies, ads on the TV, you know, the TV networks themselves, the newspapers,
which are, you know, run by giant corporations.
That's right, and it's worth looking into this. Like, they in Kansas has two major newspapers, both of them owned by the same media conglomerate, by Knight Ridder, and these people, the right-wingers in that state, just hate them. I mean, they organize boycotts, they denounce them in this just kind of ferocious, you know, way. And the papers are not offensive, and they bend over backwards to try to accommodate these people. You know, they hire them on as columnists, and they always wind up getting fired because they do something, you know, incredibly stupid. But they really do try to accommodate them, but they still maintain they're a corporate product, and they maintain this kind of, you know, there's this official sort of diversity, corporate diversity and corporate niceness, and they don't go in for idiotic conspiracy theories, and they don't talk about the working class, and that's what it, you know, and they try to keep religion out of the picture, and these people take all that as you know, liberal elitism, as a form of snobbery. What it all comes down to is, well, anyhow, I'm going to save that for next year. But
yeah, well, we'll have you back next year. You can
talk. Yeah, I have an explanation for it all, Doug. You know, I got it all figured out.
But we're just about out of time. But say a few words about what it's like to publish a small magazine in an environment dominated by gigantic publishing conglomerates.
It's actually gotten harder in recent years. You know, so many of the other magazines that were around when we started they're either gone now or they've become you know, they're virtual. You know, they go online, and we haven't done that. We're still, you know, paper-based, and we like it that way. It's you know, it's we spend a lot of time making the magazine look good, making it something that that people would like to read. And it's become much harder. One of the big factors is the collapse of independent bookstores. That used to be, you know, the majority of our copies were sold that way. And they, each of these stores, they give you special attention, and they you know the people at the store. You know, you drive around the country and visit them all. And most importantly, they reorder copies. They restock the magazine when they run out of copies. But the giant bookstores don't do that. They order, say, 5 copies for each store, and then once they're gone, they never reorder. They don't care. They don't know who you are. And that's been catastrophic for just – and they also use their market power to rip you off and to rip small publications off in a number of ways. And that's – like I said, it's been catastrophic for many – a lot of magazines. A lot of them have gone under. You remember in the early 90s there was that sort of brief media flurry over zines and stuff like that. You know, they're all gone. There's only a few. Well, I'm saying that's too sweeping a generalization, but so many of them are gone now. And hopefully the internet can take their place, but you know, I have my doubts.
A lot of the internet is gone too. So
yeah.
So how, first of all, I will once again plug the book, but how can people get copies of The Baffler if they're interested?
Well, it's you can order it through our website. That's one thing we do on the internet. You can order it through our website, which is thebaffler.com, www.thebaffler.com, B-A-F-F-L-E-R. Or you can get it in independent bookstores right about now. It should be hitting bookstores. And the anthology, Boob Jubilee, should be in stores just about everywhere because it's, of course, it's, you know, got the muscle of W.W. Norton behind it, and you know, the last of the great independent publishers, and so that one should be readily available. And you know, another one of the good thing about it is we had a fire a few years ago that pretty much destroyed all of our back issues, and so a lot of the material in Boob Jubilee is not available anywhere else anymore. And some of it is pretty funny stuff. I should mention, you know, we're coming to New York in a few weeks. We're going to be reading from the book, and I think I can promise that it will be very amusing. On the 7th of October we're doing an event at Columbia, and on the 8th of October we're doing an event at the New School. And both of those are going to be. Oh, and then we're doing one at one of the great independent bookstores in Brooklyn on October the 9th, on Thursday.
Well, I will announce those appearances when we get closer to those dates.
Yeah.
But thanks for joining us, Tom Frank.
Sure thing. Anytime.
Tom Frank is the co-editor, along with Dave Mulcahy, of Boob Jubilee: The Cultural Politics of the New Economy, a collection of articles from the Baffler magazine, and he's also editor of the Baffler, which you can visit them on the web at the Baffler. BAFFLER.com. And we'll be back to speak with Lisa Jervis after this word from Blur. Was a bit from Blur's song Money Make Me Crazy, the Marrakesh remix. And I may have my hipster license taken away for playing something as mainstream is blur, but, you know, you just got to be bold sometimes. And now we're joined by the editor of another very, very fine independent publication, which by coincidence also begins with a B. This is Lisa Jervis, the editor of Bitch magazine, whose tagline is Feminist Responses to Pop Culture. Welcome to WBAI, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with your tagline, Feminist Responses to Pop Culture. The first of all, you know, the standard image of the feminist, I hate to, it almost embarrasses me to bring this up, but I think I sort of have to, is grim, censorious, humorless. You know, I'm sure you know all the unpleasant adjectives.
Oh, yeah, I've heard
and,
it all before.
Bitch is nothing like that at all. So tell us about your brand of feminism.
Well, I think that, first of all, even though you kind of already said it, you know, that that image of the feminist as humorless and grim and censorious has just never really been all that accurate. So, you know, I don't want to come out saying, well, my brand of feminism is, you know, different, because I just think that feminism in general, you know, has never been like that. But the magazine really grew out of a love-hate relationship with pop culture that my co-editor and I share. So instead of kind of placing ourselves outside of you know, love of and consumption of mainstream movies and magazines and TV and all that, you know, we place ourselves very much in it. And
well, yeah, that's the other standard cliche, for, especially for people, you know, left of center, that pop culture is dumb and not really worth considering. It's just opiates or it teaches people to lie to themselves or makes them feel bad or, you know, any number of bad things about that. So,
well, yeah, I mean, sometimes those things are true, but the fact is, you know, look, we're soaking in it. You can't get away. And there's some stuff that, you know, speaks to maybe not our most high-minded desires, but, you know, it doesn't matter. Sometimes it's fun. And, you know, if you look at things about pop culture in such a black and white way, not only will you miss out on some really interesting stuff, but also you run the risk of kind of saying, well, that just doesn't apply to me, so I'm not ever going to think about it or talk about it. And the fact is, it influences you whether you think so or not.
Well, can you enjoy something that you know in the back of your head is somehow socially malevolent?
Speaking personally, I definitely can. I mean, I think there are plenty of, you know, movies that, you know, it's on cable. Like, hey, when Pretty Woman's on cable and I'm kind of at home after a long day, it's hard not to stop and be like, fun. You know, even though, yeah, that movie has a disgusting social message, really, which is that, you know, women just need to be rescued by a wealthy man, no matter, you know, who they are, kind of. And,
well, but, you know, despite that bad message, what's enjoyable about it, then?
Well, I mean, it's very soothing. Any kind of genre, you know, it's a fairy tale, so it's very soothing, and it follows this formula that is enjoyable. And, you know, the actors are engaging, and, you know, it's good-looking people and whatever, you know. It's hard to be immune to that. I mean, I think that...
Well, good-looking people, you know, that's luxist to say that, isn't it?
Oh, I know. I'm so sorry. Yeah, it's my... I'm sinning. But, I mean, I think Pretty Woman is actually probably not a very good example because it's not really one of the better, I mean, it is malevolent. Its pleasures are more limited, I think, than other things that are maybe malevolent.
what would a better example be?
That is actually a tough question. But, I mean, something like Bring It On is actually really one of my favorite recent movies. I don't know if you've seen it, but...
That's the cheerleader movie?
It's the cheerleader movie. It's kind of a cheerleader race relations grudge match movie. And, you know, its message is very kind of superficial, feel good. Like, you know, the premise is that there's this rich, mainly white, suburban Southern California school whose former cheerleading squad captain has been stealing choreography from this inner city, mostly African-American school and, like, winning all these competitions. And finally, the black kids get a chance to go with their own team to the competition. And, you know, it's very it's all very supposedly suspenseful and whatever. And in the end, the inner city squad wins and the white kids come in second, and it's all very like, you know, we can all just get along and now the playing field is level because you guys won this prize. And, you know, it's an incredibly superficial resolution, yet, you know, it's a feel good movie and it does feel good. And, you know, you can feel all like, oh, see, things really do work out, and, you know, but the stakes, you know, here it is basically kind of pretending to make this progressive commentary on race relations, and really it's so simplistic that it just kind of, you know, puts a salve on things and makes you feel good. And like, look, you know, there's no racism in this movie, when really, you know, it's so simplistic that it's not really kind of doing what it says it does. But, you know, it's got a really fun cast, and it's well done, and it's hilarious.
Well, so. Let's also talk a little bit about the business of publishing a magazine in, you know, this market that's dominated by even well-funded magazines that are just single titles, like Radar, just launched recently. The standard line in the magazine business is that single title companies can't make a go of it anymore. And this is, you know, a corporate magazine with national advertisers. Here you are publishing, you know, on a shoestring, a small magazine. How do you do it? And how'd you start Bitch in the first place? And how do you keep it going?
Well, we started incredibly small. I mean, how we started it was just that, you know, don't agree to spend more money than you have in your pocket right now. the first issue we printed 300 copies. So, you know, kind of keeping that going was pretty easy as far as, well, we're just not talking about, you know, big amounts. But it really took off and sold well. And when we started, we really didn't know what we were doing. It was kind of like, well, we've read magazines and we've written things, so we're going to do this. And because it's a magazine, it'll have a first issue and it'll have a second issue. And we didn't actually think further than that.
You didn't develop a business plan.
Oh, my God, no. the business plan, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have known what a business plan was back then.
And when did you start it?
It was, our first issue was published in January of 1996. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, we've grown tremendously. Now we're printing 44,000 copies of each issue, and we have national and international distribution. And, you know, we do have a little bit of advertising support. And, you know, it's an actual magazine now. But I would say that keeping it going is much harder than it was in the beginning. I mean, now, you know, we have a momentum, but thus we also have overhead, and we have you know, obligations, and kind of a really complicated business that being run by some self-taught people. So it's an ongoing struggle, and the challenges, I mean, the magazine distribution business is really, really not set up to serve small magazines. It's also not set up to serve circulation-driven magazines. It's set up to help large magazines that depend on advertising almost exclusively.
And most of your revenue comes from sales and subscriptions, right?
Yes. We get about 10% of our budget is from advertising, which, you know, I'm not that familiar with the budgets of major advertising-driven magazines, but it's pretty much the reverse. I mean, they're probably getting, you know, at least 75% of their revenue from...
I think the rule of thumb is that the cover price is supposed to cover basically printing and distribution, and everything else is covered by advertising.
Right, so. Right. And for us, that's completely, completely untrue. So we're kind of struggling against these business structures that are set up to serve, you know, a completely different purpose.
But growing to 44,000, that's pretty impressive. How do you do it? Word of mouth?
Word of mouth was the big one. We have done actually a little bit of direct mail, but yeah, I mean, we just kind of started out, literally I just put a bunch of copies in my car and drove around to local independent bookstores in the Bay Area. And that's kind of the great thing about being an independent magazine based in San Francisco, is that there's a really vibrant independent bookstore community, and everyone's incredibly supportive of a new local publication. You know, I just walked in and said, hey, you know, I have this magazine, will you carry it? And pretty much everybody said yes, and took the chance on us, which, you know, won't happen with the chains and won't happen in a place where you only have, say, one independent bookstore who can take a chance on you. So,
yeah, Tom Frank said earlier that the disappearance of a lot of those independent bookstores has really made the Baffler's life a lot more difficult. Do you find the same thing?
Absolutely. It's made all of our lives more difficult. And as a reader, you know, I feel like it's kind of impoverished my life as well. There used to be something called the Feminist Bookstore Network, which was a huge help to us when we first started. just, you know, a group of, there were several hundred feminist bookstores at that time around the country and in Canada. And, you know, we were able to use the network to get the word out to them about the magazine. And, you know, a lot of them picked us up really early on. And the Feminist Bookstore Network as an organization not only no longer exists, but I would estimate, again, I really don't know for sure, but at least half, I think, of the members have now gone out of business. And it's a huge loss, you know, to the feminist community in general, to the bookselling community, to the reading community. Well, yeah, it makes things a lot harder.
Yeah, and the feminist bookstore problem is a combination of, I guess, both the economics of independent bookselling, but also that feminism has become a dirty word in some circles.
Feminism has, I think, become a dirty word, but in some ways it's always been a dirty word in some circles. I mean, it's kind of this old joke, well, I don't know if it counts as a joke, but, you know, among my friends and colleagues, it's like, you know, we joke about how every so often some big news outlet will just run a story about feminism being dead and over. And it's been happening literally since kind of the dawn of contemporary feminism. You know, in the early 70s, people have been running these stories. So feminism has always been a whipping girl in certain circles. And that's something that also with the magazine we really try to fight against by, you know, kind of taking, again, in covering kind of the pop culture topics and the things that some people still think, you know, feminism is not concerned with, and saying like, hey, you know, this is part of feminism, and if you think that it's not, then you need to adjust your definition of feminism rather than, you know, discarding it as a concept or thinking that, you know, it doesn't speak to you or, you know.
And why do you call it bitch?
Well, purely from a pragmatic perspective, it's like, well, you know, if you're going to put a new magazine out there, you better have something eye-catching to say on the cover. So that was part of it. But the main thing really was that, I mean, bitch is a word that gets thrown around at women who are opinionated and who speak their minds and who won't back down from those opinions. And, you know, hey, if that makes me a bitch, I welcome that. You know, I'll be proud of it. So we really wanted to position the magazine as something that had that attitude, and also, you know, to take the sting out of that word, because it really shouldn't be seen as an insult.
That's a very fine word, and it also means complain in some senses too.
Yes, there is that. That is a secondary. I mean, after, you know, the kind of reclamation and opinionatedness of it is part of it, and then we kind of hatch the it's a noun, it's a verb, it's a magazine thing, which is another little slogan that we sometimes use. But yeah, it's like you can be labeled a bitch and you can also be actively bitching, which, you know, we also like to cultivate that in our readership and, you know, get people to speak up about the things that offend them.
Very noble goals. If the listeners want to find out more about the magazine or get a copy, how can they do that?
We have a website. It's www.bitchmagazine.com, all one word, and don't go to bitch.com. I mean, you can, but you'll find something very much not us. And I won't say more about it, but it you know, should be pretty clear what you'll find. We're also in a lot of the, you know, the last remaining independent bookstores, so I encourage everyone to go out to their local independent and check it out. We are also available in chain stores, but, you know, enough said about that. But there's some articles on the website, too, and ordering information and just generally more information about the magazine in general.
And a very, very fine magazine it is. Thanks for joining us, Lisa Jervis, who is the co-editor of Bitch, Feminist Responses to Pop Culture is their tagline, and that's just what it is. Very lively and wonderful product. And that's it for tonight's show. Reminder that that Ursula Hughes interview that was promised in the monthly review mailing will appear next week. Not this week. And she will be talking about the cyberterriot, workers in the information age, and a lot of stuff about offshoring and outsourcing and all those things that have become such big news in recent months that will be running next week. And also I think I'll try to put together some memorial to Edward Said. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this word from Chicks on Speed.
Good speed, Scott,